I'd like to thank Robert Hopper, who initiated the idea for this panel and was able to pull together such an illustrious group of scholars, Robert included. Monitor calls up the parents to find out if the kids were truant, if the reported absences are due to the children being home or out somewhere else. Now, it seems that when they're calling the parents, what they're doing is simply asking for the mothers to say, yes, he's home, or no, he wasn't. And it looks like the attendance office monitor is getting information. It doesn't look to be like an issue of convincing them. Now, that might be, I'm holding that. In contrast to that, it seems to be that we feel quite comfortable using the notion of being convincing when we're talking about, for example, the student coming along and saying, making claims of having been there despite the reported absence, and perhaps even giving some evidence having to do with, I was there, let me tell you what you spoke about. Now, having made this initial distinction, the reason I'm making it is because I'm not sure in the end of the analysis whether I want to hold on to being convinced, convincingness, persuasion, as a real separate business from being informed. That for the time being, what I'm looking at is coming to believe something, coming to accept something as valid, and looking at that process and trying to crack into it. Now, having specified the sort of thing I'm interested in, I was going to talk about two particular areas which have something to do with coming to believe something. One was something that you're all quite familiar with, that has to do with the credibility of the source. The other has to do with how one's own experience, one's experience fits with and is related to what you come to believe is true. I'm not going to have time to cover both of them. Both of those examples are on the handout. I'm going to focus on just one of those areas today, and that's the second. How one's own experience is related to what one comes to believe as what really happened, what's real, what's true, what's going on. I'm going to start with a few examples of things that happened fairly recently. The first example has to do with some trouble I had getting some mail at my house. The first instance, someone sent me an abstract. I have this sent to my house because receiving mail at Temple seems to be a slow process. So I say, yes, I want to get things quickly, please send it home. Well, a week or two after I was supposed to receive the abstract, there was some communication between the person and myself, and I said, no, I didn't get the abstract. And at that point, there was some discussion of, has this been happening to you? Has it happened before? And in fact, it hadn't. I mean, I hadn't had trouble. And I gave a no, and there was something that happened in that conversation, which I can only describe as greater anxiety. At which point, I don't have a recording, but I found myself searching for an occasion when I had some trouble getting mail, when some mail got lost. Now that's the first instance. Maybe a week after that, I was speaking to my father who had mailed me an article, and after an appropriate amount of time, on one Saturday I hadn't received it, and we figured, okay, it's kind of, maybe it got lost. We waited another Saturday, I still hadn't received it. He checked it out. When I said I hadn't received it, he said, okay, I'll mail you another one. A couple minutes later, a couple seconds later, whatever, I said something like, yeah, well, this happened before. I just had some problem with not getting something in the mail. And his immediate response was, well, I think you should go to the post office and talk to them about this. That's going to be the kind of thing I'm talking about. I'm going to argue that there is a real difference between the response of, well, I'll mail you another one, and the response of, you'll have to go to the post office. That's one case. Let me move on. The organization of my talk is going to be the following. The first is to talk about what we do with, how we're involved with and my experience, and how this bears on the talk, and how we might use that to argue for and be convinced of some real state of affairs. That's the first point. After talking about one experience, I'm going to move to the relevance of getting a confirmation of one's experience. And finally, I'm going to talk about something which is a rather formal object that I've written about, and that's, shall we say now, many cases, as is talked, every case. Formally, it's every case. So let me start with one case. There's a difference in we have different ways of describing. One way of describing is to describe just what we have experienced. Another way of describing is to talk about it out there, the objective world. It is. These have some nice relationship to each other. And I got interested in what people might be doing when they're describing just their own experience. I have a few examples to show the relationship. The first example, I think we can now turn to the handout. Here I have it. Sorry, the first example is not on the handout. The first example came from listening to radio in England. And I was listening to someone who was advocating snuff. And what he was saying on the radio was he was making a claim that snuff cured his hay fever. And he was very careful about describing it that way. It has cured my hay fever. Now, who cares? What was he saying? Well, I think it becomes quite clear that what he was saying, what we might hear, has to do with it being a possible state of affairs which is more than just what happened to him, which is to say that we hear that, oh, it's possible that what happened to him is more generally true, that he doesn't just represent himself, that he represents a larger class. He's perhaps an anyone, that if it can cure his hay fever, maybe it can cure mine. So, I mean, we're surrounded by people who, in fact, may tell us on one occasion or another, when you have a cold, for example, you know, I had a sore throat and I took some zinc and the sore throat disappeared. How are you hearing this? You're hearing it and they're telling it to you as a possible recommendation, as something which, in fact, isn't just relevant to them, to their life, but may be relevant to you. Now, this is the kind of relationship which I'm intrigued with, that persons indeed can form their talk up as talking about just their own experience, where, in fact, what is at stake is whether, in fact, it's more generally true. And there's issues as to how representative is this experience that I'm hearing of, you know, where do we take it? Okay, now I'm willing to turn to example 5 as an example of a telling of just what I know, my experience, and how it seems to work. This is a situation in which on a tennis court, A has just noticed a swarm of flies. I'm going to leave aside the very interesting issue of why, upon noticing, observing firsthand a swarm of flies, A has not asserted, wow, look at those flies, but has instead said, are there flies here? Leaving that issue aside, let's look at what we get back. Are there flies here? Would ask for a confirmation or disconfirmation of that state of affairs. Rather than yeah, no, of one sort or another, we get a report of my experience regarding that state of affairs. Now, my experience regarding that state of affairs is I haven't noticed any. So we have a report of an experience which speaks for or argues for the case of, the actuality of, no, there are no flies here. And in fact, you'll see people making descriptions of just their own experience, where they're building in, to a greater or lesser extent, how representative they want it to be. So that, in fact, they can say, I haven't been looking around, and I haven't noticed any. Or they can say, ever since I walked in here, I was expecting them, I've been looking, and I haven't noticed any. So we have ways of either making it a stronger claim for a state of affairs or a weaker claim. With respect to these reporting just my own experience, They are done on occasions where, they're done on several occasions, they're done on occasions of doubt, but they're also done when there is some sensitivity involved. They're a safer way, they're a more cautious way. They're done when there's issues of liability. For the snuff example, it was a public forum and there was an issue of liability. On this one, there is the issue of disconfirming what you are suggesting with your question. A second point about this is that even with a rather limited claim, which is to say, I'm just reporting what I'm noticing, I'm not telling you what is out there, and moreover, I'm not even making a strong claim for what I'm reporting is my experience. Even with that rather weakened assertion, we still have something like what might have been established as the real state of affairs is drastically dented, let's put it that way. That if we're talking about how something comes to be ratified as real, here we have some a reality which is suggested, and with even a weak disconfirmation, it can become a little more fragile. Good, so the overall point about reporting my experience is that there are occasions in which we hear such thing, we hear the report of one experience, and we are concerned with, sometimes we hear it as quite likely representing a real state of affairs. Other times it's strong enough for us to be tempted by that. But there does seem to be the issue of how representative is it. We do that. Let me move to the issue of confirmation. I think the really exciting part of the work of getting confirmation of an experience or of some particular state of affairs has to do with attribution, has to do with how we come to understand why something is going on. There's a lot of work with that issue of why is it happening, how is it happening. Now, if we turn to example six, what's going on in example six is that E is complaining about her husband, with whom she's having some difficulty. Sometimes they're together, sometimes they're not. And if we go down a few lines, E's complaint is that I can't say anything, I'm stupid, or if I say something about a man or the government, you know, oh well, it's me too, you know, it's me too, Lottie, you know, I'm no bottle of milk. Okay, she's just been complaining about her husband. She's just been describing a bunch of troubles. She's essentially been talking about how difficult he is. She stops herself, or at some point along the way, she reflects and now is stating another position with respect to whose fault it is. First of all, blaming him, then reconsidering and saying, oh, well, it's me too, Lottie, I'm no bottle of milk. Now we have the position of a recipient coming along. What is this recipient going to do? How are we going to establish what the facts are, who's responsible, what the reality is? Well, we have some very nice response here. The first thing that L does is simply assert, on the basis of her experience, assert a contrary position with respect to E, so that we have, oh, well, you're easy to get along with. Okay, so we have something like one person said, I'm no bottle of milk, whatever that means, and the other person saying, no, you're easy to get along with. But now, with respect to how do we have this trouble? What's the source of the conflict and trouble, and who's between this couple? What L then does is go ahead and talk about the husband. And what that talk is, I know he's that way. I know he's that way. Oh God, just to go fishing with him drives me up the wall. Now, what I would argue is that when E first first blames her husband and then sort of steps back and says, wait a second, we can't just put the blame there, it's my fault too. What's up for grabs now is the issue which does become central for people, which during conflicts, as to who's responsible. And that issue then is worked on. And how it's worked on is, L is working on establishing that, in fact, it is the husband. Now, how do you come to establish that? No, it's not an interactional matter. The problem lies with the husband. Well, one way you come to establish that is by ratifying, by having a same experience, by coming up with a confirmation. And so what we're talking about, in effect, is the power of a second experience, the power of a confirmation or second experience in determining who's at fault, which is to say there's some kind of logic working here where we have trouble. I think it's his fault, but who knows? I mean, we're having trouble. Someone comes along, someone says, I have the same trouble with him. Moreover, I have it even in these casual situations, the most casual situations. That turns out to be a tremendous relief, where if you can find someone else who has the same troubles you do with this person, you can then end up saying, it's not me, it's not my fault, it's in that person. And that seems to be going on an awful lot. Good. Okay, let me move to the last major area. I said that people use their own experience to talk about more than their own experience. I mentioned that people use one other experience, a second confirming experience, to figure out what's happening, to get even a confirmation of the attribution they're making. Now, consider example 7. Now, in example 7, I'll just tell it to you to save time. This woman who was assigned the job in a club, they were selling fruitcake. The job was to sell these fruitcake. Now, she decided to cut the fruitcake in half and sell halves of fruitcakes. The way she's talking about it is not being proud of it as an accomplishment to have thought of such a wonderful thing, but rather defensively. She says she has to do it, she only does it to a select group. There's lots of evidence that she is feeling defensive, being defensive. Okay, part of justifying this action, if it's going to be justified, is building some kind of situation which would argue for the necessity of having to have done that. That's the work of justifying. Let's say... Now, if we start with a situation that there was a way of doing it, that there was a defined setup way of selling these fruitcake. It was organized by the club, you sell whole ones. She goes along and she encounters, let's say, one customer who, when she's trying to sell this, the preferred, the ordinary right way to sell fruitcake, one customer says, my God, how come it costs so much? Well, what do you do with this? I'll tell you some things that people do with one instance. One thing that you can do with one instance is essentially write it off. You can figure that, why is this woman so tight, man or woman so tight about money? What's going on? That doesn't, it has no implications. It doesn't have to have implications. Well, what happens if you then come up against a second customer who does this? How many does it take? Well, I'm not going to answer how many does it take. What I want to argue is that at some point something happens. And that thing that happens has some implications. What happens is you take it seriously in a different way. You're not going to write it off. You're going to say this represents a pattern. One of the ways in talk of saying what I'm talking about cannot be written off is to use what I've called an extreme case formulation. what it looks like over here is that in number 7, what the woman says is, well, I'm doing it to the few people that I know, because every time that I say 325, they look at me like, you must be nuts, woman. Every time doesn't mean every time. It's not talked about like that. It's not treated like that. Every time says, we can't write it off. It's going to have implications. And it speaks to the work of what is it to produce a justified course of action. I'm going to have to stop there.
Thank you, Anita. Robert Harper, as the only one of our speakers today who has not been schooled in conversation analysis, has nonetheless been an ambassador for it and a doer of it for some 10 years now. And I think as much as anyone in the communication field, Robert has bridged conversation analysis and communication, helping make each more accessible to the other. He has also, I think more than anyone in communication, inspired communication students in their love affairs with conversation. Robert is talking about several things today, including some ways to begin playing.
Some handouts are being passed among you. I brought 50 or 60, and I think there are more of you. If those of you who have already picked up the paper could use your copy of the paper and continue to pass the outlines, the handouts back, the examples are numbered the same in the paper as on the handout. I have at least 3 titles today, and I'm sorry, I'm too eclectic, I'm sure. Title number 1, Some Ways to Begin Playing. Title number 2, Switching Partners in Conversation, which is probably the best title. And partner number 3, when I write this for Psychology Today, I'm going to call it Call Waiting. Originally, the talk was called How to Begin to Play, and my text for that title was probably my favorite essay in the world, Gregory Bateson's essay, A Theory of Play and Fantasy, in which he argues something like this. Metacommunicative messages, whatever those might be, help us define situations, whatever those might be, by accomplishing framing, whatever that might be. Now, as actors in the ongoing drama of conversation, we do orient ourselves to things like beginnings and endings of encounters. How do we accomplish these things? Compared to what? I keep trying to grasp these things, and they keep kind of occluding me as well, I'm sure. We do have a few positive examples, like Manny Shagloff, who talks about openings and closings in very persuasive ways, and I hope that I am eloquent enough today so that I can be seen as in some way a minor footnote to that talk. How do people, what I'm asking, how do people stop talking to one person and start talking to another person? Now, this is an ongoing concern, of course, at Speech Communication Association cocktail parties, but I'm going to talk about a somewhat more controlled substance environment here. A simple example, an example taken from modern day electronic semiotics, and that is the call waiting episode. The call waiting episode is that if you are a subscriber to the service that in Texas at least is called call waiting, you pay a monthly fee so that at any time during an ongoing phone conversation, you could be talking to somebody and you will suddenly hear beep. And that means that there's somebody else who would like to talk to you, the subscriber. Right? Now, so there are 3 parties involved here. There's first of all the party that I'm calling throughout, subscriber. And I'm calling these things that as though they were called that from the beginning, but of course these are all reflexive achievements. You become the subscriber when the thing goes off, right? Okay. So you're the subscriber if you hear that beep surrounded by those 2 little clicks. If you're on the other end of the line, I'm calling you partner. You're the person who happened to be there when this bullet comes out of left field to call your conversational partner. And what you hear, at least in the ones that I've heard, is something like, you don't hear the beep. And that's how you tell if you're 2 buddies and you both have call waiting, who's got the call waiting, right? Usually today I'll just be doing the clicks because it's hard to do the beeps and overlap with other talk that I'll be reading to. If you look at example 1, you have, I think, a sort of a plain vanilla case. You have a partner saying, I don't know what I am, and subscriber sort of doing a half-hearted laugh at that, and then there's a little gap. And there's no talking going on at the time when you have the beep. Subscriber then says, could you hold the phone a second? Yeah. Okay, hold on. And then there's another switching noise, very like the first. And I one of the reasons why I'm crazy about these little situations is that you have little bookends here. One of the problems in thinking about situation definition in a way inspired by Bateson is that nothing ever really seems to just begin. A telephone call does, and of course that's one reason why we have work on openings and closings coming from telephone conversations. But ordinary conversations, sometimes like if you're at a cocktail party, you sort of look at somebody across the room and then you sort of begin talking to them and you fade out of it and fade back into it. Here we have a nice little event, and everything in that little episode has to be after the opening clicks and before the final clicks. So it allows us to narrow our environment. And somewhere in between those two clicks, the parties have to switch partners. Subscriber has to get a new partner. Partner has to give up their old partner so a subscriber can trade them in. Okay. First of all, think about this first click as what the partner thinks it is. And what the partner thinks it, I'm sorry, not the partner, but the caller, the new caller in thinks it is. What they think it is I'm just making a phone call to my friend Sam, right? I don't know that I'm interrupting something else. That's what I think it is if I'm the caller. And what happens if I call somebody? I expect somebody to answer my telephone call, as has been nicely pointed out, by an answer to a summons, which is usually some kind of reply that has some characteristics of a question, like, hello. And then that obligates the party who made the summons to say something else and obligates me to listen to it. I think that what happens at call waitings is a little cousin of that, sort of. So what happens at line 9 is, subscriber says, could you hold the phone a second? Like other answers to summons, this has some characteristics of a question. But the question is not addressed to the summoner in this case, because you're not talking to the summoner yet. The question is addressed to your partner. So you're using like the same tool you would be using in another kind of situation, but it's doing something slightly different. Okay, so you say, can you hold the phone a second? And you get yes, some kind of confirmation of that. K, hold on. Sometimes I refer to these as hold on, okay episodes, because in almost every instance that I come across, they have a hold on and an okay on them, but that would be a fourth title, so I won't talk about that. The point about example one is that the summons occurs in a gap between turns. Now, this still leaves subscriber with a choice, right? Subscriber might choose to ignore that summons and go on with the conversation. That happens. Somewhat more routinely, I think, that the subscriber will say something like, could you hold the phone a second? And choose to discontinue the conversation that's going on and try to begin a new one, to go into some kind of a switching episode. Well, how do you accomplish this transition episode? How do you look at that more closely to try to figure out what's going on? The first thing, I think, is to see subscriber as a person who's bought into this sort of double summons obligation. I have this recurring conflict in my life because I subscribe to call waiting. Every time it goes off, I got to make a choice between the old partner and the new partner. I might go on with one, I might begin the other. One kind of resolution to this conflict, I think, is illustrated in line 9. Could you hold the phone a second? You ask a question to try to obtain a suspension of the turn-taking you're doing with the person you're now talking so you can start something new. Again, some characteristics of a question. It's a nice, quick, implicit thing. People don't seem to say, I seem to have another call coming in. Could you please hold the line for just a little while and I'll try to get back to you as soon as possible. They say things that are sort of quicker, more implicit, and I guess that little thing is sort of well enough known in most of our communities now. Maybe that's sort of all you have to say. But notice the sort of fast-paced character of these things as I go through other examples. What makes some of these examples really interesting is that it's surprisingly rare that the call waiting summons occurs in a gap between turns. And I guess this is one more instantiation of how well the turn-taking model works. We really do try to minimize things like gap between turns, and so usually when a summons goes off by random chance, it's during somebody's turn. So look, for example, at example 2. This is very early in a call, and all I want to say about example 2 is there's some business going on there. You might say it's pre-sequences toward making arrangements to go to dinner. And in fact, after the call waiting episode, they do come back and make a date to go to supper. Pretty good. Have you eaten yet? It's very early in the call. No, I haven't. You haven't? No. Do you have Eddie's car? Felicity condition being checked out there. Yeah, I do. You do? Mm-hmm. It's yours. Okay, just a minute. Again, now focusing in just on between these two little brackets, starting with the beep and ending with the switching. It's yours. Okay, just a minute. I don't want to say anything more about that, except in this case, There's a little bit more about it in the paper. But in this case, there's business on the floor. It's not like the first case where the conversation was sort of not going much of anywhere, except that it was still being a conversation. Here, there's something really sequentially imperative that's going on. They seem to be making arrangements. And those arrangements are suspended, and you get on to something else. So it's like here, business as is going on is set aside in favor of responding to the summons. Now compare that with example three. In example three, a person is asking a question, as Anita was talking about a bit ago. It looks like a kind of a question that maybe a confirming or disconfirming response would be pretty relevant. The company just writes it off. Now, do you notice that that really becomes a question with that final trimarked question mark syllable, off, right? And it's right at the moment that that off is sort of clicking in the speech act that question is, that the call waiting summons occurs. So now there is sequential business on the floor of, I think, a really tight order. Ordinarily, a question of this sort gets answers from a very restricted category of kinds of tokens that you employ. And a good example of this is the response 165. No, man, the company, don't write it off. Was that your phone or what? You know what's happened here. See, first, this time, you postpone the call waiting just a tad. And you get the other sequential business done. But notice when that's done, the person moves very quickly. And that's why I've got these little tie signs, equal signs, at the end of 165 and 166. He gets right on with it. He really selects himself for another turn to deal with the summons at that point. Now, that's a very brief delay to do some ongoing business. Example four is an instance of a longer delay. And this is a very clever accomplishment by a caller. This begins actually with the very start of this call. Right after the ring, the partner says, hello, Pat, yeah. And right in the middle of this beep, I can't do it. It goes, beep. Only in the middle of the beep, it's, is Laurie there? This guy speaks right into the beep on his telephone. I don't know how he pulled it off. Of course, the partner can't hear him because they're getting silence on their end during that thing. I think the whole line is dead. So they do a little pardon. He repeats. He doesn't say at that point, as he might have said in some of the other instances, right? Could you hold the phone a second and I'll ask you more later. He goes on. Is Laurie there? She's doing her laundry. Okay, we have her call me when she gets back. Sure, thanks, bye-bye, bye-bye. Hello, is Dave there? Yeah, hold on 1 minute, okay? Now, I think this guy's pretty inventive. And it's not a terribly rare kind of invention. I think it's the kind of invention to which call waiting subscribers are almost routinely driven. And that is that you've got some ongoing business on the floor. One of the things you might want to do is take care of that business so that by the time you respond to the summons, you're not having to leave anybody on hold. Now, if I'm giving practical advice to call waiting subscribers, one piece of advice I would give them is remember, and it's something, you get that thing and you get kind of immediately agitated. You remember that the other person doesn't know that they're call waiting you, they just think they're phoning you. And actually, you probably have 20 or 30 seconds in which to answer their telephone. If you answer them right away, they're going to say, what's the matter, or something. They're going to be startled, right, at how fast you answer the telephone call. And so this guy's clever. He's able to get in his whole telephone call, realize he's not able to connect with the party, leave his message. There doesn't seem to me to be anything really hurried about the way he does this. And there are 6 seconds between the two clicks in this case. The first click that says there's a call waiting for him, and the second click where he actually begins to switch. Just as you may then, you may just switch immediately, as in example two, I think it was. In example three, I'm all confused about my numbers. Anyway, certainly in this last one, there's quite a long delay in example four between the summons and the response to it. As you may delay the call rating response for quite a while in order to finish up your business or to do even a piece of your business, another thing that you may do is you may try to hurry up and get your business done, so that you can get on. And that happens, I think, in a kind of a nice way in example six. I can't really give you the whole beauty of example six because it's one of those moments that Borman, following Bales, calls fantasizes. It's one of those wonderful little, everybody sort of gets carried away for a minute. And what happens is you see a sort of a pre-closing at line 109 and 110. Person begins to excuse themselves, they get an okay on that. You get the feeling that in the normal order of things, this telephone call might last anywhere from 2 to 4 seconds.